This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. The COVID-19 numbers are going up in Illinois. We'll hear from an administrator about what it means for his healthcare system. College students are having to adapt to a new normal, and the experience just isn't the same. We'll talk with some freshmen. In Chicago, outreach is part of the city's effort to address street violence, but those doing the work are feeling the effects.
The work can be tiresome sometimes, can be overwhelming. And there's a period of burnout. You know, when you're responding to situations and shootings, there can be a period of burnout and you don't know it.
Schools in Illinois are now required to teach LGBTQ history. We'll take a closer look at what that means. And how to control invasive plants. One idea is to bring in the goats. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll look at the pandemic and what it's meant for nursing home employees and those who live there. We'll also hear from a doctor about concerns he has as Illinois' COVID-19 numbers go up and as we head toward the winter months. And LGBTQ history. Now it's required to be taught in schools, but what will that involve? We'll have those stories and more coming up. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's plan to address the city's high levels of street violence depends on outreach organizations. The groups send men and women out to shooting scenes and gang corners where they try to connect with people in their neighborhoods. That means almost daily contact with pain, and many of these outreach workers have their own past traumatic experiences. It's a problem the groups are trying to solve. Patrick Smith tells us more.
When there's a shooting in the Humboldt Park neighborhood, Tony Rags heads out to the crime scene as quickly as he can. He talks with family members and friends of the victim and tries to find out what groups were involved.
We just try to gather as much information as we can to try to diffuse it and make sure that another situation doesn't happen behind that one.
Rags manages the Safe Streets program in the Humboldt Park neighborhood. He's over a team of workers who go into some of the city's most violent blocks to offer an alternative to the people doing the shooting.
The work can be tiresome sometimes, can be overwhelming, and there's a period of burnout. You know, when you're responding to situations and shootings, there can be a period of burnout and you don't know it.
There was an evening in July when that burnout took him by surprise. He says he was in the middle of talking to someone who had lost their brother in a shooting that day. They had reached out for help, and Rags was trying to comfort them and help them figure out what to do next. As he talked, his voice began to crack and his eyes welled up with tears.
The person came to me for comfort and ended up giving me comfort as well. So I had to step back and say, hey, you know, I need a day or two to just sit back and, you know, either get this out or something. First person name came to mind was Tina.
Tina is Tina Cooper. She's a counselor who works in neighborhoods throughout the city. Her main job is to provide therapy for people who are trying to leave a life of street violence, the clients of the anti-violence workers. But she's also looking out for the anti-violence workers themselves, people like Rags.
I think we did two sessions, and it was just what I needed. You know, sometimes you need to not necessarily vent and rant, but just get some things off your chest.
Sometimes it's really just therapeutic just to be listened to.
This is Tina Cooper.
You know, the outreach workers are boots on the ground. They're exposed to so much trauma and violence. So we're just making sure that they know that we're here and that, you know, we're here to listen whenever you want to talk.
Obviously, Cooper didn't tell me what her and Rags talked about in their therapy sessions. But Cooper says generally, it is really important for guys like Rags to talk through their emotions and trauma. Rags has lost a lot of friends and family to gun violence. That's true for a lot of the people doing this kind of work.
Because of their experiences, it makes them that more qualified to do the work. However, because of what they've already experienced, and then to really be re-experiencing those things by being in this work, burnout can be quicker.
Many of the outreach workers, like Rags, say they used to be in the streets.
You would hear a lot of them say that, I used to be out here terrorizing the streets. Now I feel like it's on me to fix it, you know, to right my wrongs. right? So I think some of them are so gung-ho to fix things that you can almost become lost in it. And the boundary lines can get very blurred in that, and you may find yourself going above and beyond and doing the work that you could hurt yourself.
There's a reason Cooper immediately came to mind for Rags when he was struggling. She's always there, offering support or just checking in, pushing people to take care of themselves. It reminds me of a term you hear a lot if you spend time with street outreach groups in Chicago: relentless engagement. It's this idea that you just keep showing up, keep reaching out. The guys on the corners carrying guns will turn you down over and over again, but you need to make sure you are there for that moment when they decide they want to try something new. The mental health professionals in this world take the same approach with their coworkers. Considering how much trauma they have to see almost every day, and that many of them have their own traumatic histories, I asked some of the anti-violence workers if the organizations they work for provide enough mental health support. They all said yes. They say the biggest issue is they don't take advantage of what's available, even though they know they should.
I've been putting it off.
Ashaki Banks is a victim advocate in Austin. That means her job is to respond to shootings and murders, comfort grieving mothers, and help figure out funeral arrangements and things like that. Banks has been shot before, and she lost her own young daughter to gun violence. It's hard to think of a job that could be more traumatizing, considering Banks' history. And she says Cooper is on her all the time about getting help.
She laughed at me, too. Like, you ain't coming. I'm like, I'm going to come talk to you. I promise I'm coming.
Is it Tina who works?
Yeah, here? Tina. Oh, yeah, I love her.
But I can't her. Get you to sit down with her.
Nope.
Too busy?
And I'm too busy doing nothing, though. It'd be the crazy part about it.
It's surprising. Banks had just gotten done telling me the story of her daughter's murder, killed by a stray bullet. She's not afraid of talking about painful moments in her life, but there's something about therapy that she's avoiding. Cooper says she gets this a lot. People who know they'd be well served by spending some time talking with her, but who just keep putting it off.
For some, you know, they might not want to feel vulnerable, because in counseling it does require, in order for you to start the healing, you do have to let down your guards and be vulnerable. And I think from them being in the streets for so long and having to learn how to survive, they had to build this wall to protect themselves and their feelings.
Cooper says she gets it, and it doesn't help to push. Her job is to just keep checking in and making sure to be there whenever they are ready. Patrick Smith, WBEZ News.
COVID-19, the presidential election, racial injustice, so many have said we need to come together to solve them. Peter Medlin reports on how schools are trying to come together as a community when a pandemic is often literally keeping them apart.
Over the summer, the school year was still in limbo, and racial tensions were running high in Rockford as well as communities across the country. A former student reached out to Amanda Becker with a simple question. Mrs. Becker, how are you going to teach about this? Becker's a history teacher at Auburn High School and a Rockford historian. Her answer was a philosophy she learned from her own teaching mentors.
The best thing to do is to let the kids talk. That's it. Don't teach them anything. Let the kids talk.
It's an interesting exercise to teach U.S. history in an era that's historically significant in and of itself. Becker says that's not lost on her students. How could it be when they only come in person twice a week, masked up and from a distance? Carol Perez is one of those students. She's a junior at Auburn.
A lot of my classmates, especially ones who had not been very politically active in the past, I noticed that this year they were using their voice a lot more than they had in the past.
That's been in part due to the protests against racism in Rockford this summer. She says racial justice and police reform, along with climate change, are the topics people she knows her age care about the most right now. She's not old enough to vote, but she's still getting involved. She's going to be an election judge. She's a little bit nervous, but it's still exciting to be part of the process. Student Election Judge Coordinator Jonathan Lagerman says they've had a much harder time recruiting students with Winnebago County COVID-19 case rates jumping. Fewer than half of Americans between 18 and 29 years old voted in the 2016 presidential election. Elizabeth Zorn says young people often don't feel like they can make the change in the political system they want to see. Zorin is a government teacher at Auburn, so it's part of her job to show students how to harness their power and their voice to make a difference. But how can students make a difference during a pandemic? She can't push them to knock on doors or even go to in-person events like board meetings. But her students will be doing civic action projects.
And be able to talk to other kids from around the country, as well as they're going to be having like actual politicians and people engaged in movements where they're going to be able to discuss things with.
The program includes some founders of March for Our Lives. Zorin says they're going to study civil rights movements and other organized efforts before deciding which cause they want to devote their attention to. What about at younger grade levels, years away from casting their first ballot? Justin Sechek says it's a question they've been asking at Rockford Public Schools. He's a language arts teacher at West Middle School.
When a student graduates from high school, we hope that they have developed into a compassionate, empathetic, socially engaged individual. How do we backwards plan that? And what do we need to teach and how do we need to support at each developmental level?
He says current events like COVID-19 or the election flow into middle school classrooms as well. Sechek is a musician, so he likes using music and literature to organically introduce his students to tough subjects.
Nothing's not political, you know, and if you're not challenging the status quo, you're supporting the status quo. So I would say that my class definitely isn't absent of those things, but I've been really conscious of how I'm approaching it.
The online classroom can also facilitate more individualized interactions. And he says deeper connections and smaller in-person classes can really matter, especially in districts where a large number of students are classified as underperforming. At the elementary school level, Lori Leathers says it's all about forging relationships with kids. She's the principal at the STEAM Academy at Haskell Elementary. Broad conversations about politics and elections typically don't make it into their classes. She says that even though they've had to recalibrate the hands-on instruction Haskell's known for, she's really proud of how teachers there have gotten creative to keep students engaged and feel like they're part of a school community even from under a mask. Nearly half of Rockford families chose remote learning to start the school year. But it's been impossible to not confront the issues facing the Rockford community and beyond during a pandemic and an election year. I'm Peter Medlin.
The pandemic has hit nursing homes especially hard. More than 6,400 nursing home residents in Missouri have contracted the coronavirus and over 1,000 have died. Some families and employees say staff shortages have gotten worse during the pandemic, making it harder to care for residents. St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan has more.
Bonnie Seyfried used to sit outside her husband Frank's window every day for hours. His nursing home, the Woodlands of Arnold, suspended in-person visitation in March, so Seyfried would set up a folding chair and a little umbrella under a tree outside.
On good days, they would face him in a chair facing me, and we'd wave, and he'd give me a thumbs up, or he'd say, "Hi, honey, how are you?"
The 76-year-old wrote messages on a whiteboard, updating him on their kids and grandkids. And the longer she sat by his window, the more she noticed that staff were not coming to check on him, sometimes for hours.
He'd have to go to the bathroom, and I'd get up, and I'd start pacing because they weren't coming to the window. And every time I'd see somebody walk by in the hall, I'd bang on the window, and he'd put his hand up, and he'd go, "Sweetheart, sweetheart, calm down, calm down." I said, "But you have to go. I know you have to go."
Seyfried is very familiar with this particular nursing home. Her mom lived there, and she worked in its administration for 7 years. She says they haven't had enough medical staff for years, but things got much worse when the coronavirus pandemic hit, sickening at least 141 residents, including Frank Seyfried. His wife watched helplessly as his health deteriorated.
I could see he was panicking. He couldn't breathe. And his face was flushed red.
She called the front desk, asking them to give him his prescribed breathing treatments or bring him water. But she says staff were completely overwhelmed. Nursing homes across Missouri and the U.S. have long struggled with staff shortages, but the crisis has worsened in recent months. Nursing assistant Shonda Whitfield says a lot of workers have gotten sick or quit.
It was a lot of people that was just scared. You know, so some people left voluntarily, some people left from health issues, some people contracted the COVID and then come back.
Whitfield takes care of 20 residents at Estates of Spanish Lake in North St. Louis County. When coworkers don't show up, she works 12 or even 16 hours a day by herself. She caught the coronavirus in April and was sick for about a month. Whitfield has an autoimmune disease, and her doctor said it might not be safe for her to work there anymore. She decided to go back.
I'm like, okay,
what if I take a chance to contract it again? What if it'd be worse this time?
Nursing home workers like Whitfield, many of them women of color earning low hourly wages, have had to weigh whether the paycheck is worth the risk. Nursing assistant Michael Howard works at Grand Manor in St. Louis and says he personally knows workers who have decided the pay is too low to put their lives on the line. That means he and other staff are often pulling double shifts.
When you short staff, you become vulnerable because you get tired. You'll be woke, but your body is not there with you like it should be. And you know this. You feel it, but it's nothing you can do because guess what? You still got to work.
More than one in five U.S. nursing homes reported staff shortages this summer, according to a national analysis of data from about 15,000 facilities. That's left families in a tough position, says Michelle Gralnick, whose parents live at Delmar Gardens West in Chesterfield.
In general, basic needs are not being met because the staff that is there are either pulled in too many directions, or the staff, the seasoned staff and the staff that had relationships with the residents are no longer there.
Her mom, Rhoda, has multiple sclerosis and is paraplegic. She's supposed to be turned every 2 hours under state mandate, but sometimes she's been left in bed all day, Gralnick says. She adds that even though facilities were caught unprepared by this pandemic, 6 months is long enough for them to figure out how to keep residents safe and let them live with dignity.
It goes beyond they didn't die last night. It's easy for people to say, well, they're getting food and they're getting clothed, right? Yeah, but when they moved into a nursing home, the emphasis was supposed to be on home.
Back in Arnold, Bonnie Seifried no longer sits by her husband's window. He died in late July from COVID-19. Seifried doesn't blame the staff. She says they're underpaid, overworked, and dead tired. But what happened to her husband? Seeing the fear in his eyes as he lay alone in his room, that still haunts her.
When you see something that's not right, that shouldn't be that way, you have to say no. You know, this is not something that we should blanketly accept.
She just hopes that we'll learn from this so it doesn't happen again. I'm Shayla Farzan.
You're listening to Statewide. We appreciate you tuning in. Still to come, LGBTQ history, now a learning requirement in schools. We'll hear more about it. That's next. We're back on Statewide. Some might view a goat as a nuisance when it creeps into your garden or eats something it shouldn't, but they can play a role in controlling invasive plants. We'll find out more. That's still ahead. The schools now are required to teach LGBTQ history in Illinois. Maureen McKinney, for this week's Illinois Issues Report, took a deeper look at what that means. And a note that this story includes derogatory terms that reflect bullying treatments of LGBTQ youth.
The kids call Grayson Alexander dyke and faggot. The bullying got worse when he came out as transgender the summer between 8th grade and high school. The Springfield native is now a senior at Loyola University in Chicago. He says attending school was, quote, not fun.
Especially when I was trying to navigate that process of figuring out who I was and where I fit in. Being gay or LGBT or trans never came up in any way at school, and it left me feeling really alien.
He said he believes there's greater acceptance of trans people and that the level of vitriol he experienced has lessened. This school year, students in Illinois are being taught about LGBTQ historical figures such as Leonardo da Vinci, the artist and inventor, and the pioneering Illinois social worker Jane Addams. Conversation about those individuals will be woven into the curriculum for students as early as kindergarten. Alexander says he hopes the new curriculum will not only help LGBTQ students feel visible, but also teach non-LGBTQ students to not marginalize their queer peers. The instruction must occur by the time students graduate 8th grade and will be required in high school in a one-year unit of history. State Senator Heather Staines, a Chicago Democrat who has an adult daughter who is transgender, introduced the measure.
When you don't see who you are reflected in history in positive ways, it can just really harm self-esteem. And in these critical years, as you are going through puberty, there's really high levels of suicide for LGBTQ population, high levels of bullying. And having inclusive curriculum really does help change the environment for kids.
But some believe the legislature has no business dictating what schools teach. Among them is Chicago Tribune columnist Eric Zorn. Zorn said he believes teachers should talk about the contributions of LGBTQ individuals.
I have a real problem, though, with state lawmakers who are not really well versed in history and are not experts in education telling local school districts exactly how they should be micromanaging their curriculum.
Stain says she understands why some oppose more mandates. One teacher said she and her colleagues should have no trouble incorporating the issue. Eighth grade teacher Amy Biancari said she plans to teach about LGBTQ contributions at her Aurora school later in the year when she covers civil rights.
There's been a big shift in, rather than covering chronologically with events, it's more about big concepts and ideas, and that struggle for rights is a big concept and idea that's foundational in our country.
Gresham Magdaleno works for the Public Health Institute of Metropolitan Chicago, directing the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance. Those entities are part of a consortium helping to draft the legislation and prepare curriculum. Magdaleno said the incorporation of the discussion of gender nonconformity for students as young as kindergarten should not be controversial.
It could be as simple as students can do examples of diverse families. So there are stories that show depictions of same-sex parents or transgender young people. Even though you don't necessarily have to go into the specifics of it, you can still provide representation without sexualizing it in any way.
Carrie Vine agrees. Her son, Cal, is a transgender sophomore at Carbondale High School.
I think it's important for the youth of today to know that it's not a new thing. It's people that are gay and lesbian or bisexual or whatever have been around for a long time. It's nothing new.
Victor Salvo leads the Chicago-based Legacy Project, where he worked with teachers to create a lengthy, ever-growing series of lesson plans with multimedia features for the inclusive curriculum.
People will be really shocked by how uncontroversial it actually is. Indeed, the most controversial thing about this is the fact that it exists at all.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
You can find more information about the new curriculum at our website at statewideshow.com. Most Midwest farmers are white. In 1900, there were about 300 black farm families in Iowa. Only about half remained in 1970, and the numbers continued to decline for decades. Amy Mayer explores why there are few black farmers today.
Driving along Highway 150 in Fayette County, Iowa, you see a giant propane tank painted to look like a watermelon. It's the site of a produce stand, owned and operated by one black family until the 1990s, the family of Atrus Stepp.
Everybody's got good things to say about Eddie.
That's Charles Downs. He's white and bought the place from Stepp's daughter. Stepp died in 1993 at the age of 97.
Conservatively, I say it's been here 80 years, at least, and it's probably close, maybe 100.
Stepp's family traces roots to a small but thriving African-American farm community. Before the Civil War, a group of people of color found their way to Fayette County. Trinity Christian College history professor David Brodnack Sr. says with the assistance of a white minister, they bought their own land.
These black farmers, they left their white neighbors alone, and their white neighbors eventually left them alone.
Brodnack says after the so-called Fayette mulattoes, many of them were of mixed race, other African Americans came to Iowa and other Midwest states. He says some 19th century black families saw owning land as a first but not final step toward economic freedom.
You get yourself some land, and then you send your kids to school, and then you have even more economic power. So in that sense, you don't necessarily need to hold on to that land.
Other scholars have posited that in the upper Midwest and Plains states, black families leveraged land for a couple of generations to catapult themselves into comfortable lives in more urban areas. But Valerie Grimm, an Indiana University professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies, says that may be the case for some, but
That's not my experience in talking to black landowners at all. It was always property that you kept to protect your family.
So there would always be a home to return to. Meanwhile, Grimm says agriculture in the 20th century threw many hurdles up for African Americans. Seed dealers who wouldn't sell to black farmers, black land-grant universities that didn't have adequate research money, and federal farm programs that denied loans to black farmers.
By the early 21st century, black farmers had won more than $2 billion in settlements from discrimination cases against the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Grimm says even more is needed, like a fund to help African-American farmers get started.
It wouldn't make up for 400 years of domination, oppression, and discrimination, but certainly it would increase the percentage of blacks involved in farming.
But in Fayette County, Iowa, there's another reason for the loss of black farmers: assimilation. Jeff Schimmick identifies as white, but he's also a grandson of Addie Stepp, of that pioneering black farm family. He recalls speaking with another man, one who identifies as black, who also comes from one of those early families.
Well, he says some members of the community just wanted to act as white as they could and assimilate into the whites as best they could, and he says your granddad was that way.
Schimmick and his cousin Brian Stepp say no one really talked about their mixed-race background when they were growing up. Brian Stepp worked on the farm with their grandfather for about 15 years.
Brian, put $1,000 into this place every year and you'll have something when I die. Look where I am. I have no $1,000 every year.
Even if a Stepp descendant had kept farming, it wouldn't change the fact that in 2012 and 2017, the Census of Agriculture showed Fayette County had no self-identified black or African-American farmers. But statewide, the tiny number is growing, mostly in urban areas, and many are recent immigrants. Broadnax, the historian, says farming isn't among the current calls for black economic empowerment.
What I haven't seen is that being addressed from a perspective of farming and land ownership, right? Not saying that no one has said that, but it definitely does not seem to be any kind of big part of the conversation in 2020.
But black restaurant owners, urban gardeners, and local food activists are renewing conversations about who grows their food. All signs that African-American interest in agriculture is growing, which ultimately could bring about a new generation of black farmers in the Midwest. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Forests across the country have a problem with invasive plants wreaking havoc, choking off native plants, and destroying wildlife habitat. A national forest in Missouri is experimenting with goats as a solution. Jonathan All reports it's a natural and cheap alternative to herbicides and mowing.
Dozens of Spanish goats are roaming around a field in the Mark Twain National Forest in the Missouri Ozarks. The vegetation is about waist high, making it hard to see them from a distance. They are here to eat Cerasisa lespidiza, a woody, flowering herb native to Asia that makes this area uninhabitable for quail and turkeys. Brian Davidson is the Botany and Invasive Species Program Manager at the Mark Twain National Forest. He says the goats are helping not only with what they eat, but also with what they leave behind.
They're defecating all over that, so that gets incorporated in the soil. And
so between what they eat and what they poop, they're the natural weed and feed.
Yeah. What goes in comes out, right? So, and all of that has a lot of nutrients.
The fields and glades in between large groups of trees are super important to the health of a forest. They provide habitat for wildlife, areas for wildflowers to grow that help bees, and act as fuel breaks in case of a forest fire. But plants like blackberries and kudzu can invade and decimate those spaces.
They create a large canopy, they compete for nutrients, and then they push out and eliminate a lot of the desirable native species that we have.
Davidson says getting into these areas to cut away the brush is difficult and ineffective. Using herbicides can kill native plants and is bad for the environment. And the goats are quickly eating their way through the problem in this 3-acre field. It will take just a day or two to clear out the weeds, leaving behind tall grasses. This goat herd belongs to Lauren and Elizabeth Steele of Elk Creek, Missouri. They contract with landowners to bring their goats in, set up temporary fences to control where they go, and the goats do the rest. Elizabeth Steele says they got the idea when they were looking for ways to keep trees from coming back to their own land that they had cleared.
It's a lot cheaper than running equipment over the land to get rid of those resprouts or using herbicides. We decided to use goats, and then that just started the process for us of looking at what the goats eat and what they are effective on.
The Steeles say one of the most common misperceptions about goats is that they will eat anything. Lauren says he often hears the old stories about goats eating tin cans or the sweater right off a child at a petting zoo. But he says goats are not indiscriminate in their diets. And what makes them different is that they will eat plants that no other animal is interested in.
So they're pretty picky, however, they will eat a lot of stuff.
They eat some grass, but they concentrate on broadleaf and brushy browse type species.
The Steels own about 1,500 goats and bring most of them out on jobs like this one at the Mark Twain National Forest. And while the process is very natural, this is a business. The $25,000 contract the Steels have with the Forest Service has specific benchmarks for clearing plants from certain areas. But the goats don't seem stressed by the workload. Lauren Steele says it's a pretty good life for a goat.
They get shipped to a new place on a regular basis. So it's kind of like having a new smorgasbord on a regular basis. And I think it's pretty good.
Using goats to control vegetation isn't new. The practice goes back to when the animals were first domesticated. What is new is the targeted approach and using precision planting to take out specific plants in particular areas. Davidson says the next step might be to take the goats out of the open areas and see what they can do among the trees.
Where we have a lot of native hardwoods that are encroaching and are impeding pine regeneration and also not maintaining that openness with all that regen we get. So we're using goats in there to try to maintain that structure.
Davidson says he thinks forests will increase their use of goats to help maintain land because they continue to prove to be cheap, effective, and natural. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Many entertainers were forced to step out of the spotlight when COVID-19 appeared, but what happened to those behind the camera? Yvonne Booz with WNIJ explains how the careers of two Northern Illinois video professionals have been impacted.
Joseph Piscitelli is the owner of Broadcast Production Services in Lombard. Most of his work includes commercial projects for businesses throughout Northern Illinois. He says last year's gross profit was his best, but this year's is his worst. He remembers what happened when Illinois went under lockdown.
It was like, you know, going 150 miles an hour and then hitting a brick wall. It just literally shook your world. Everything came to a dead stop.
Piscitelli says the world came crashing down around him. He was trying to figure out how to make a living after doing the same thing for over 30 years. He got so down that he says he didn't even touch his video equipment. Instead, he poured all of his passion into his family and working out. Piscitelli shares at one point he questioned if he needed to go back to school. He wondered if he should go and get a regular job at a place like Amazon or FedEx. He held out because he says he had a feeling that things would pick up again, and he wanted to be available if a production opportunity popped up. But at the same time, he needed money.
I called my accountant and we had several conversations, and he's like, Joe, you know, just don't worry about your pride, man. You've earned this. You can take this. Just go get the unemployment. It's going to help you and your family.
Piscitelli says the government help, which included a payroll protection program payment, was the glue that kept his finances together. Lonnie Iske is the owner of Vixen Productions in Rockford. Her company offers total production services for live events and some corporate and commercial projects. She says things came to a standstill for her business when COVID-19 showed up.
We kind of lost all work that we had. Everything got canceled. Weddings got postponed and moved. And then about, I'd say May and June, we would get a couple things here and there.
Iske says regardless of what was going on, she has never once thought about changing careers because production work is her passion. And that passion and her tenacity are what's helping her maneuver through the storm. The pandemic made a lot of people switch gears. Most live events went virtual, and some of them needed a production crew to make that happen. Iske was there for the call.
Trying to get videos out for virtual events and anything you can think of, really. Every business is freaking out right now, I think. And just like, we need online content.
Iske says her company has been swamped since the beginning of September. Piscitelli confirms that things shifted for him in July. He slowly started getting a few jobs here and there.
And then I had a fantastic opportunity, not only financially, but also, again, one of those other just cool projects. I was able to go on the road for 2 weeks with the Weather Channel for storm stories.
He says this is when he was able to stick his chest out and chin up again. Piscitelli mentions that September almost felt like a regular month, but it's too soon to tell what will happen. He also shares that if needed, he may pivot to virtual work. He admits that he is still a little nervous, but he feels much better than he did a few months ago. Iske's sentiments are the same. She says she was very concerned at the beginning of the year.
It's just been a wild ride, and we're all kind of trying to navigate and pivot and learn our new norm.
Iske wants video production people to stay motivated and not press the pause button. She suggests they work on small personal projects and share them. She says you never know who is watching, and that small work could snowball into something bigger. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Coming up on Statewide, some college freshmen tell us what life is like in higher education in 2020. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a chief medical officer for a hospital system in Illinois lays out his concerns about the coronavirus situation and what might lie ahead. But next, in an unpredictable semester of college, many freshmen are developing their own routines. It's obvious this year of college life is lacking in many ways. Reporter Kate McGee with WBEZ checks in on how four freshmen from the Chicago area are managing so far.
The students I'm following have settled into daily patterns. Wake up and head to their computers for Zoom classes, recorded video lectures, and written conversations via online discussion boards. They're finishing up their first round of midterms, and some have joined a few clubs that meet over Zoom, including Karen Rodriguez.
I joined the biology club. I really love biology, so I'm kind of like, I literally geek out in this like club. I'm just like, yes, evolution, like Darwin.
Rodriguez is attending the University of Southern California, but she stayed home in Chicago's Archer Heights neighborhood this fall. She wanted to help out family and save money on housing. But as she spends every day in front of her computer, she continues to ask herself,
am I getting my money worth?
As the first semester continues, some students who aren't getting that on-campus experience are questioning what they're paying for, even if scholarships and financial aid have helped reduce the cost. Take Julia Korzeniowski.
Me and a lot of friends, like, we have definitely shared the same views. It's just kind of like you're paying for what seems like glorified YouTube videos.
She's a freshman at the University of Illinois at Chicago who is taking classes from her family home in suburban Hoffman Estates. She feels she's missing out on an important college experience, making connections and building relationships.
There's only really two classes where I regularly meet with whether it be my professor or a TA, and pretty much everything else, either I have very little communication or I literally have not talked to them at all.
Rodriguez says she's contemplated transferring to a school locally, like the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she has friends who are living on campus. She finds herself reaching out to her high school counselor for advice or help rather than staff at USC.
That connection, that communication is not there.
U of I is one of the few schools nationally that regularly tests students for COVID-19, and they anticipated students like Rodriguez would yearn to be on a campus and want to transfer. This spring, they're allowing all schools to accept transfers, which they don't normally do. Still, that doesn't mean Rodriguez would get a normal college experience. Most classes at U of I are still online. Elizabeth LeBeau is a freshman there, and she only has one in-person class this semester. She says she often zones out watching recorded lectures, and it's easy to procrastinate on social media apps like TikTok.
I feel like I would be a lot more motivated if I like went up and like walked to class every single day.
But Ismael Beltran, a freshman at Colorado College from Chicago's Gage Park neighborhood, thinks this fall is worth every penny. He's loving the freedom of being on campus, meeting new friends, and living in his dorm room.
Even though we do have like our COVID procedures and like social distancing measures, that doesn't mean we don't have fun. Like me and my friends, we sometimes go to 7-Eleven to get slushies at night, or like we have a movie night. It's not the complete experience, but some.
Still, there are drawbacks. Colorado College students attend classes one at a time in a block schedule. Beltran says he's only spoken to two of his 14 classmates since school started, including one student a few weeks ago.
I saw his cat crossing the Zoom, like his camera. So I just had to text him and say, like, oh, your cat's cute. And then I started having conversations with him.
Regardless, these students continue to show up for class and awkward club meetings on Zoom. For those on campus, there are still 6 weeks until Thanksgiving, when most colleges are sending students home for the semester. Beltran might stay in Colorado for Thanksgiving to avoid exposing his multi-generational family in Chicago. Another thing for students to think about as they prepare for the second half of their fall semester. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
Northern Illinois University is expanding COVID-19 testing efforts into what some might consider unexpected places. That would be wastewater. Peter Medlin has more on the science behind making waste an ally to fight the spread of the virus.
Dr. Barry Bode was the longtime chair of NIU's Department of Biological Studies. Now he has a new title that he could have never anticipated, Director of COVID-19 Facilities. Partnered with the Kishwaukee Water Reclamation District, Bode's building a lab and assembling a team to implement a new component in the university's surveillance testing plan.
Wastewater testing is literally taking samples of wastewater from different access points and assaying the wastewater for the presence of the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Those access points are mostly residence halls, as well as neighborhoods around the university where a lot of students live. Bode says initial reports show the virus is traceable in the stool of around a third to half of infected people, even before they show symptoms. Studies show it might persist in their system for weeks. The idea is to monitor high-risk areas like dorms for spikes in COVID concentration and catch outbreaks before they even happen.
You can then refocus your other testing resources on subjects that may either live in that residence hall or in that neighborhood.
So far, Bode says the results at other colleges have been promising. The University of Arizona credited wastewater testing for preventing the virus from spreading in its dorms back in August. NIU has avoided an outbreak of COVID-19 so far. Positive cases peaked in September and have been down since. But the university is in Region 1 of the state's reopening plan, where positivity rates recently topped 10%. And Illinois and surrounding states continue to struggle with both the number of cases and deaths due to the virus. Wastewater testing isn't limited to college environments either. Spain and Italy, among other countries, have invested in similar nationwide programs. At NIU, Bode's lab is hoping to be in a process development phase by November. Then they'll be ready to test wastewater streams on campus and in the surrounding community by next semester. Bode says it takes a lot of steps to process a sample once it gets to the lab.
Wastewater, as you can imagine, is a very complex medium to try to measure things in, as opposed to, say, a nasal swab or saliva.
And a range of factors come into play, even depending on where the wastewater is taken from.
Sewer lines contain a mixture of a lot of things. There might be buildings that use a lot of water, so a lot of water goes down the drain. There are others that may have food processing, like if, for example, if you have a residence hall with a dining area, you're going to have a lot more kind of food residue going down the pipes.
That also means before any testing, Bode's team has to collaborate with the city to see if the storm sewers and sewage systems converge. With the help of student researchers, they collect the wastewater with a tool called a composite sampler.
It's an instrument that's designed to take a small volume of wastewater at specific time intervals over, say, 24 hours.
Once it's in the lab, they start with around a liter of wastewater. They process this matrix so they can concentrate and measure COVID-19. Bode says by their final tests to find the viral RNA, its volume is the size of a single drop of water. Science is hard, Bode says, and that's why it's by nature a communal process. But it's also hard to collaborate during a pandemic.
Now we're having to go into our research laboratories one at a time or two at a time if the lab is large enough and no more. The isolation we feel at home kind of is extending into the laboratory as well.
That often makes the process slower, which can be frustrating when COVID-related science is often asked to go at warp speed. Luckily, with wastewater testing, they're part of a consortium of colleges sharing techniques and best practices. Bode reiterated that as effective as they hope wastewater to be, it's just one part of the university's testing strategy, and it's definitely not a silver bullet. In the meantime, he says personal mitigation methods, like wearing masks and social distancing, are going to play a pivotal role in containing the spread of the virus. I'm Peter Medlin.
In April, Memorial Health System hospitals in central Illinois were treating 10 to 15 patients for COVID-19. Now, 60 to 65 patients on average are hospitalized for the disease. Dr. Raj Govindaya is the chief medical officer at Memorial, which runs hospitals in Springfield, Decatur, Jacksonville, Taylorville, and Lincoln. Mary Hansen talked with him about how the virus has spread.
Several months ago, we were seeing clusters of cases that would be brought into, say, an extended care facility. Now it's just people in the community who have fatigue from all the social distancing, the mask wearing. They're a little bit tired of all the social isolation, and they're hanging out. In doing so, they're inadvertently spreading this illness.
What are some of the additional challenges, aside from availability of beds, when there are so many COVID-19 patients?
So we have this really ironic double whammy there are more patients because more people are getting sick in the community, more of the people that would care for them get sick too. If the disease continues to surge like it did in other places of the country earlier this year, or we add a flu season on top of it, we won't have enough healthy staff to take care of the patients who need care. That's what we saw in other communities around the country, and that's what we want to avoid.
Memorial recently laid off some folks. Are you going to be hiring people back if you're facing a shortage of workers?
We did not lay off anyone who provided direct patient care. It was all back office, non-clinical facing people who were important to Memorial, but in this environment, we could not manage all the pressures we're facing. We are hiring nurses, we're hiring techs, we are hiring phlebotomists.
And are there things that the community needs to be doing right now or the health department needs to be doing to help control the spread of the virus?
Yeah, I think we already know the things that are effective. We just need to commit to doing them. Wash your hands, wear a mask, watch your distance, and get a flu shot. These are the simple things that we can do right now to stay healthy, not get sick, not get others sick, and to stay out of the hospital or make sure that that healthcare provider who does go and take care of people in the hospital doesn't get exposed as well. That's why the vigilance, even in the face of fatigue of all of this stuff that we have to do, is still so important. And ironically, it's more important right now than at any other point during the pandemic for Central Illinois, because we have the most disease circulating in our community right now.
Are you surprised by where we are right now, that in October we have the highest number of cases and hospitalizations?
Quite frankly, I am not. I'm disappointed, but not surprised. When I talk to my friends around the country, talk to them about what's transpired in their communities, and then I see our own behaviors, I think we need to take a hard look in the mirror. I have been out to a restaurant twice outside in a tent since March. Even outside, I felt kind of uncomfortable because even just sitting across the table with them unmasked, I realized I was probably putting myself in a position that I shouldn't be. We all slip up. It's impossible to be perfectly vigilant, but we kind of all need to count on each other to be vigilant for each other. And when I see what's happening in the community, I realize that is not occurring as frequently and as often as it needs to be.
Do you expect to see a continuing rise in cases and in hospitalizations?
If we go back and look at the way the disease has spread, coming out of every holiday, there's been a bump up. The holiday that kind of set us back was Labor Day. In other parts of the United States, it was 4th of July. What's different between 4th of July and Labor Day for us? Well, around 4th of July, there wasn't a whole lot of disease activity in Central Illinois. Our behaviors were probably pretty similar, but the amount of disease activity was different. We had just enough dry kindling that the match of Labor Day lit it a fire. And now it's spreading, it's smoldering. And we have these other holidays coming up, and I'm worried they're going to add fuel to that fire.
For the holidays, what is your advice for people who are making those really tough decisions about whether or not to see their family?
Every time you meet with those individuals, you are meeting with everyone that they have been in contact with too. And do you really understand how many people that is? And do you really understand the risk that you are placing yourself in, or you are placing your family member in by all the people you've interacted with? So just be cautious.
And how is the hospital preparing for the possibility that hospitalizations could still increase and infections could continue to rise?
We've been preparing since the start of the pandemic. It starts with educating our staff so that we can safely take care of COVID and non-COVID patients. Making sure that we have the right resources. So do we need more personal protective equipment? Making sure we have the ability to test people who require care and ideally rapidly or urgently in a short turnaround. making sure we have the right medications and drugs so we can treat people. So we've been taking this time to stockpile all of these resources, and we feel comfortable we have the stuff we need to provide the care, but we need the people.
That's Dr. Raj Govindaya. He's the chief medical officer for Memorial Health System, and he talked with Mary Hansen. That's all we have time for on Statewide This Week. Be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes are available at statewideshow.com, and our weekly podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.